You are listening to
Worldwide Engineering.
Worldwide Engineering.
Worldwide Engineering.
Worldwide Engineering.
Hey, what's going on, Worldwide family? Welcome to this episode. I'm definitely glad that you are here today because today's episode was just great. I had the chance to speak with Justin Hunt, who's a great friend and who's the founder of Blaze Transit. Blaze is looking to completely revolutionize the public transportation industry by integrating AI and machine learning inside the kind of archaic and old public transportation infrastructure. Blaze is backed by some of Canada's largest incubators, including Techstars and Next36. It was honestly refreshing having this conversation with Justin because I had met Justin 3 years ago at an engineering conference. And back then, both of us were really involved in, you know, engineering academics, and none of us were really business owners. And it was really fun and fascinating seeing how people can, in such a short amount of time, can change and can achieve so many things. Justin and I really got to dive during this episode into his startup, the types of services he offers, as well as entrepreneurship in terms of how was Justin able to turn this concept he had, this idea he had in engineering school, and actually make a business out of it where investors and big clients are willing to pay money for his services. Also, guys, Blaze is looking to hire new people, so keep an eye out or keep an ear out for announcements from Justin regarding the job description, as well as who and where is he looking for the people. With that said, guys, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Also, guys, on a side note, I just wanted to let you know that I'm really proud of this worldwide engineering community we've built and wanted to thank you for the amazing launch, or pre-launch actually, we've had for our first edition engineering student agendas. This week we've released the giveaway just to launch and to celebrate the pre-order phase. And on Monday, we're going to be opening the official pre-order phase. If you're interested in pre-ordering the agenda for September, we're going to be opening that up on Monday for 48 hours. I'm just really happy by the amount of support I've received from all of you, and I just wanted to thank you. With that said, let's dive right into the podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. See you very soon. So SCM recently published a stat, and they noticed that metro transportation dropped by 80% compared to last year. 80% drop. For buses, 75%. Now, you could make the argument that this is temporary. Like, once life gets back rolling, you know, people are going to start taking public transportation. But do you really think it will? And I want your opinion as an expert in the transportation industry, and then I'm going to tell you why, how that relates to the airline industry, for example, and what I think of this.
Yeah, so I've seen those stats and been following them as well, and I think it would be very naive to assume that they're ever going to come back to what they were pre-coronavirus. I think that people's transportation habits and patterns have fundamentally changed. And so I think that any sort of transportation service needs to be looking at these numbers and really reassessing what their next steps are. Because a lot of them I see right now are already, like transit authorities, for example, are trying to go back to old schedules, to old routes, even though the data that those were planned with is all now obsolete, in my opinion. We were just discussing before this about people working from home. So if you have a huge percent of the population that's only working from home, or have flexible work schedules where maybe they're coming in one time a week or twice a week, these are all things that need to be now taken into account. Or, you know, older populations that are more vulnerable, they take up a huge proportion of public transit users, those who, you know, don't drive or choose not to. And so I don't know if they're ever going to get back into a bus or into a crowded metro if they know that there's a risk for them. So I think that things will not go back to normal. I think we're going to see some very interesting trends, but we have to be very agile in terms of how we're making decisions and flexible, which unfortunately most, you know, large transportation providers are not that flexible at the moment. They have these fixed schedules, fixed routes, and they just want to keep them like this and go back to the way that they were and expect everyone else to adapt to them. But we take a bit of a different approach, so which we'll talk about after.
Yeah, because Yeah, I'm sure you've heard recently of Warren Buffett, for example. He sold all his stakes in airline companies. Have you heard of him doing that? And this is a really milestone. I see it in the future of transportation as it is, because he said in his statement explaining why he did that is that the transportation industry is never going to be the same, quoting him. And that means that people's behavior has fundamentally changed. You know, we were talking about this before. You know how it takes 21 days to build a habit, right? We've been in lockdown for more than 2 months right now. So people have adapted to this new way of living. They've adapted to commuting less. So now when you used to go once a week to the groceries, now you do it once every 3 weeks, but your quantity increases. You commute less, you work from home. So a lot of companies are shifting, such as Twitter, Shopify, who are creating permanent job positions from home. So I think it's going to be the same with the transportation industry, especially buses and trains. And I do think maybe people's behaviors, their perception of what is safe and what is not, is going to change. So we might see an increase actually in people buying cars or people buying bikes. You know, especially, for example, St. Catherine. This year, they're going to be closing all of St. Catherine through the whole downtown Montreal, and they're only going to make it a walking street, pedestrian only. And those are the types of changes that, once you implement them, they're going to realize, actually, pollution is lower this year in the city, overall well-being is higher. So those are the types of things that I have no doubt that next year they're also going to close that street. But more specifically for Blaze, for your company, how you have hands-on data, you work with companies, how hard were they disrupted right now? Like how has your company been adapting to this change?
So do you want me to give a bit of an intro to what we do well? Yeah. So Blaze is a software platform that allows transit authorities and bus operators to run on-demand bus services. So what this means is that instead of having city buses follow the same paths or the same routes and the same schedules every single day, they're now changing constantly in real time based on passenger trip requests that we receive. You could say we're kind of like the Uber for city buses. I don't love using that that term, but it is a way to get people to think about it in an easy to understand way. So we work with mostly like small to medium transit authorities right now to implement this service. We provide the software, they provide the buses and drivers. The impacts have been pretty pretty negative, like you said, those stats. And it's not only are they seeing decrease in ridership, but they're having trouble monitoring it, because everywhere around the world, people getting on at the back of the bus, it's been free. There's no validation. So there's a huge loss of data. So we can't even do a good job at monitoring how people's transportation habits have changed, because we've lost all of this data because no one's validating. We don't know where people are getting on, getting off, who's getting on, who's getting off, all of these things. These stats are often pulled from apps like Transit App or Google Maps or Move It, things like that, where they can monitor the decreases of like 75-80% in ridership. So there's been a loss of data, a huge loss of revenue that they hadn't accounted for. Luckily, most have received a lot of government funding to support maintaining their services throughout. But I don't know how long they'll be able to sustain this decrease in revenue and ridership. So in terms of how we've adapted, I mean, it's actually been quite a perfect storm for us, and it's slightly bittersweet because ridership is so low and it's so variable. This is the perfect time for on-demand. It's the perfect time to be adapting our transit systems in real time based on where people are going. So we don't have empty buses on the road, so we don't have buses following long unnecessary detours, and instead we can send buses where they're needed and always following the shortest, most optimized path based on these requests. So it is it's kind of a weird moment for us because our industry has been hit so hard and so negatively, so it's tougher to sell into, but at the same time the problems that we're solving have been accentuated and brought to the forefront now because of all these COVID related issues. So it's exposed all of these problems. In terms of what we're doing specifically to address this, we're implementing capacity limits on the buses, which is something that we can do because anyone who uses a Blaze bus will have to make a request through the app. So we can control how many people are on it at any given time. So we can set that limit to say 15 passengers per bus and make sure that everyone can social distance and have their own bench sitting to themselves. And we've also implemented a really cool contact tracing feature. Once again, because everyone who is getting on one of our buses had to have made a request with the app. So we can track that person, we know who they are, not track in any sort of, negative way. It's all anonymized, of course. But if they identify that they've had symptoms or are COVID positive, we can actually alert everyone else who they've been in contact with on one of our buses in the past 2 weeks and say, you need to take extra precautions. At one point, you were in contact with someone who was positive with COVID.
I'd like to talk about the software. I'd like some more context about that, your servers more specifically. So I went on your website and I saw a video or an animated picture that you had on there about how the bus, usually typical buses, they have the destination. They go from A, B, C, D, E. They have a set schedule. But what you do, for example, if you notice that there's no one standing at E, at the stop number E, the bus just skips that stop and takes a faster route, correct?
Somewhat. So people, it's not fully on demand where we won't look, okay, there's no one at that stop, we're gonna avoid it. We get the requests 15 to 30 minutes before leaving, and then we plan brand new routes. So we're not even considering what was previously done. It's not like we're changing the ones that are already, the routes that are already on the road. We're making brand new ones entirely. So people put in the request and we say, okay, get to this bus stop at this time. They get to that bus stop and then the bus comes, picks them up and brings them to a bus stop near their destination. So, but of course, like the path between all the bus stops is all optimized and we're only going to stops where people are getting on or off. So it's kind of what you said, but just we're not tweaking the existing ones. We're really, starting from scratch and just seeing what's best.
You were telling me that coding the software and releasing it was a tricky part. Can you tell me a bit about this? How did you get to a point where you actually started hiring people that started code? What type of language did you use? Like a bit of the in-depth.
Yeah. So we can, I can definitely go into detail there. So navigation and any sort of mapping apps are one of the most complex and expensive to build in kind of the app development world, because it's not just about these front end interfaces. There's a lot of math and operations research that needs to be implemented to figure out where vehicles need to go, where people are in real time, where the vehicles are in real time and routing them. So there's a lot of really complicated math behind that. Most startups, when they start their business, they're told to come up with an MVP and launch that and get feedback on it. Our challenge, because we're not the ones operating the buses, we work with large transit authorities. A large transit authority, like if you think about, an MTA in New York or TTC in Toronto or the STM in Montreal, is not going to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into a pilot project with us with an app that barely works, that doesn't look very good. So the standard for what we had to create to actually be able to launch was a lot higher, where it had to be, kind of at the same, close to the same level of an Uber or Lyft type app, but made by us as a startup with very limited resources. So we first started with a mobile version. With a web version, sorry. We didn't go fully mobile at the beginning. And that's what we used to get feedback from focus groups and from potential users of the service. So it was built on the front end with React. So it's a responsive kind of front end framework, and then on the back end, we mostly use Node.js, so JavaScript languages, and then our algorithms are all written in Python, and actually a bit in C++ for speed. So we use quite a variety, and we have kind of three separate teams. So there's the front end developers, the back end, and then we have our mini algorithms team, where we need people that have a background in operations research and transport optimization to be able to work on that. And so at first, it was just myself and my co-founder. I studied mechanical engineering, did some software consulting in internships, but would not call myself a very good developer by any means. Luckily, I managed to recruit my chief technology officer and co-founder. He studied mechatronics engineering, which is more robotics, but they take a lot of software classes, and he had been building apps since he was 15 years old. He built his high school's scheduling app for BlackBerry when he was 15, and that's the kind of person that he is. He's very resourceful, very much a self-learner. So when I brought him on, he basically took over all the development of everything, and he kind of brought it from, I would say like 0 to 60 or 0 to 80. He got working versions of everything. They didn't work super well, but that's not the point. And then once we had a basic version, we could sell it and get some investment, and then we hire people that are better than us to take it to that next level. So that was kind of the path that we had to take. It's always, making incremental progress and then using that progress to go get some more, say, funding or some more clients, and then with that money going to make more progress on the tech side. So it's very much this kind of like ladder or zigzag, I guess would be the better way to put it, where you're always kind of hopping from one opportunity to the next to just kind of make your way incrementally forward.
You know what's fascinating, man? When we had met in 2018, we were both, really involved in university. We were mostly involved in university. Yeah. And it's crazy how in a two-year period, between 2018 when we met and 2020, how things can move fast. Like back then we were both still students. And, look at you here. You actually have a product, a solid product that's ready to get launched on the market, that has investors backing it. And it's really motivating to see that, especially for someone who's listening, probably like we tend to underestimate how much we can achieve over 2 to 5 years, So how did you go from the phase where Blaze was an idea, it was just a concept, to actually developing it and turning it into a product? And I'd especially like to know the part about getting funding. I'm sure that's a tricky part, the moment where you have to start dealing with people and try to convince them why the idea works. That's where it gets tricky. Because as entrepreneurs, we always tend to convince ourselves. We have this bias where we convince ourselves that our idea is good. Because, we have this preconceived bias. But once you start pitching it and you put it in the market, a lot of times you realize that actually, no, it's not that good. I had failed 2 businesses before that for the simple reason. Like the core foundation was that I thought the idea was good, but it's not what the market wanted, basically. So yeah, take me through the different chapters that you've been from the idea, conception, and funding.
Yeah, so I'll start with the idea, and this is kind of one of the main key messages I like when I talk about or I like to promote when I talk about entrepreneurship, is to not necessarily start with an idea, but with a problem that you have. Because a lot of people say, oh, I don't know, I can't start a business because I don't have any brilliant ideas. Ideas are really just problems, and there's problems all around us in our day-to-day. And that's exactly how I came up with the kind of idea behind Blaze, was just sitting on empty buses for, since I was 14 years old, living in the suburbs of Montreal, waiting for bus that never showed up, having to transfer, having to, wait outside in the cold when it's minus 30 degrees. And then, of course, being alone on the buses, it makes long, unnecessary detours. And I thought to myself, I kind of like put my engineering cap on. I said, well, how can I actually optimize this whole system? Like, why are there 40-foot diesel buses that are empty on the road for a good portion of the day? That didn't make sense to me. So this was the problem that I had. And then once you have that problem identified that you're passionate about, that you're aligned with, then you need to think about what are some solutions to that. And I think what's really important is to be in some ways agnostic to what that solution is. So once you have a problem, you need to be thinking of a wide range of different solutions, because you may try one solution and then you may go try to validate it with the clients, and they're saying, no, we don't actually want this. Okay, well then what's another solution that you could have to solve this problem? For me, it was picking a problem that I was passionate about, that had you know, a positive social impact, positive environmental impact, and that also involves some like cool technology that we could develop. So once I'd found that problem and started coming up with a solution, then the next step is to kind of is to validate it. And so we spoke to dozens of transit authorities and heard what their problems were, heard what the solutions were, and many were asking actually for these on-demand systems. On-demand has existed since the 80s, but it was just people calling in, and then someone would like, you know, put an X on a map and then hand that over to a driver, and literally some small cities still do it that way today. But they had seen the promise of this and seen how it had worked in other cities, even, you know, with apps in other cities, but there was no kind of universal solution out there that was affordable. Back to kind of my own journey in this, once we had that validated, I was in this entrepreneurship accelerator program called the Next 36, based out of Toronto. I'd gotten into this in my last year of university without even an idea or business, and started the business in the program. So they accept people that have entrepreneurial potential, and then they give you the resources to really start a business and kind of help you along in this journey. So this was summer of 2018. I just started the business in the spring, graduated from that program in August without, we had done a lot of validation. So I had a lot of conviction that this was the right path, this was the right idea, but I had no funding, I had no team, I was by myself, we had no clients, no product really. I had some mock-ups and some really like rough prototypes, and I had no money as well personally, so I had to move back home. I moved back to Montreal from Toronto to live with my parents' basement and spent the next 9 months there. So I would say that was one of the most difficult parts of the journey, was still staying motivated and pitching to clients and to investors with such conviction, despite the fact that you're just, you know, you feel like you have nothing, you know, except for the passion and this vision for what your product or business could be. So to skip ahead a few steps, we got our first client, and we didn't even have a functional product at that time. And so I like to describe that part of the business as it's kind of like you jump out of a plane and you're building the parachute on the way down. And once we had this first client that believed in us, then and I was able to recruit my CTO as well, then things started to roll a bit more. So this was, we're getting into like spring of 2019, where we had our first two angel investors come on, Toronto-based angel investors that put in some money, and we had a first couple early grants, small amounts from the government that we had won, and this was enough for us to hire our first developers over last summer. So we were a small team of four or five people last summer. And then towards the end of the summer, we had our second major client. Because these are bigger clients, it's not the kind of industry where we need to line up, you know, like, 10. These were bigger contracts, bigger clients. So we had our second major one also in the province of Quebec. And then with this, we got into Techstars, which is one of the best accelerators in the world. We got into the artificial intelligence one based here in Montreal, funded by Real Ventures. And this is a 4 or 3 month program that really the goal is to spend this time accelerating the business, helping it grow, helping take it to the next level. So I'd say it's about 2 years worth of work crammed into 3 months. And that definitely held its truth, I would say. So it was not kind of a straight path for us. It wasn't like we came up with the idea and got our first client and you know, raised a bunch of money. It's really, you know, we raised in different stages, from grants, from angel investors, from Techstars, and even, you know, we had client revenue as well at that point. And I put in even a bit of my own money. So it was quite a blend of financing. And I think that's what you need to do as an entrepreneur. Like, you may not be able to just say, okay, I have this idea, I have my team, let me go and raise $1 million. It may not be that simple. And so you need to consider all other options. What are other ways I can get funding, or could I do it without funding? You know, you may think I need $1 million to hire this engineering team, but could I actually just spend a little bit more time and figure it out myself and get the traction that way? So I think you need to be relentless in your pursuit of this mission, but there's a lot that you don't control at the end of the day when it comes to financing. And so you need to be creating as much optionality for yourself as possible. Think about, you know, all the different ways that you could achieve this, and you need to get very, very creative, because it's not, you don't have, you know, a huge cash flow. You don't have, you know, the money to do everything that these large companies can that you may be going up against. So you need to get very creative to kind of hack the whole business process until you get something that's functional.
Did at any point, I mean, you graduated in engineering, did at any point start considering, I should stop here and go find a job?
I didn't. My parents did. They definitely, you know, up until a few months ago, were still pushing me just to go out and get a regular job, and were sending me job, you know, opportunities at large aerospace companies and stuff like that. Until they saw that, you know, okay, we had a lot of funding, we had clients paying us for this, and I had a team around me. So, I had done a lot of internships. I'd done 6 internships throughout my undergrad. And really, each one of these was just figuring out what I didn't want to do. It was so clear to me by, you know, the third or fourth one that I didn't want to be part of a large corporation. I didn't want to kind of fall down the typical corporate path. Not because there's anything wrong with that, but that just wasn't for me. I wanted to have an impact. I wanted to have the freedom to execute on ideas I had. I wanted to have control over what I worked on, who I worked with, all these different aspects. And so I knew that entrepreneurship was for me. And then I started, you know, taking steps to make that happen. So needless to say, when I started the business, I definitely didn't expect everything that was involved in doing this, but yeah, it's extremely difficult, but also extremely rewarding. So I didn't really consider that at any point that I would go and get a job, but I knew that that was always an option. And so that's why I think for people that are fresh out of school, like ourselves, who are maybe thinking, oh, I need work experience to start a business. Really, if you want to get good at starting a business, go out and try and do it. Like, that's the only way. You're not going to, you know, gain anything on the entrepreneurship side by going to work for a multinational, like, you know, 100,000 person company. So I had the very little to lose, just like I'm sure you do. I was lucky. I didn't have any student debt. I don't have a mortgage. I don't have a family to support. So really, what do I have? Like, if this whole thing did fall apart tomorrow, well, I've learned a ton over the past 2 years. You know, I've managed a team. I've gained an amazing network. I've gained a great reputation in the business world. And so if I failed, I could just go get a job tomorrow. But the reverse isn't always true, where if you have a job and you get accustomed to a certain lifestyle and a certain salary, well, then going a year and a half without a salary is a lot tougher to do, in my opinion, than when you're freshly graduated from school.
So if there was someone who was joining university today, he or she was starting her first semester in September, and his or her goal in the future is to build a business, is to become an entrepreneur, basically, something in a field they're passionate in, most probably engineering or technology, because that's the field they chose. What is one of the best decisions you made during your engineering degree that formed you to become the person you are today? And I feel we are going to have kind of the same answer, which is actually getting out there in university, getting involved, going beyond the classroom, because those are the things that will develop your character. You know, where we met in conferences, getting out, public speaking. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think someone who's starting. So engineering is a great field, in my opinion, to do anything with. It's a great discipline to study, to do pretty much anything, because it gives you, you know, one, credibility to people outside. but two, it just allows you to learn how to take very large, complex problems and break them down into smaller, kind of manageable steps. So that's like kind of covered by academia. And it's a super useful skill in business and in most disciplines that I can think of. But then what they don't teach you, which is super important in you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, is all the people skills that are involved. So how to sell, how to manage a team, how to, you know, recruit a team, how to convince someone that your idea is something that's worth their time or their money. So whatever you can get involved with or do throughout your degree that's going to help you fine-tune those skills, I think is the best way to invest your time. So that could be getting involved like we did, where you have the opportunity to have a different set of responsibilities that force you to be taking initiative, to be managing a small team, to be doing a lot of public speaking. That's another critical skill to being an entrepreneur. If you can't speak, how are you going to convince people or talk to people about your product or your vision? And then if, you know, maybe the extracurriculars isn't for you, starting, you know, a side hustle, a small business on the side. Not only is it a great way to finance your education, but it's also a good way to practice all of these skills that I just mentioned about selling, dealing with clients, dealing with the team. So I did a bit of both of those. So I was involved with our student associations and engineering school at McGill, but then I also had a couple small businesses on the side which I was using to fund my education. Nothing very interesting, and they were kind of ones that I would do on the weekends or the evenings, and never really took to the next level. But it allowed me to deal with clients, to deal with all the kind of like basic business issues that you have when you're starting up. So and being in school is a great place to take those small risks and experiment a little bit, and that's kind of what I would say on that front.
That makes a lot of sense. I'd like to know, man, from your perspective, you're the expert in this field. Who are some of the players that are pushing the industry forward, or what are some of the technologies, I'm going to say, that are pushing the industry forward? For example, do you see at one point Blaze integrating automation or artificial intelligence into your products and softwares? Or, for example, who are some other companies? For example, Elon Musk is, with his Boring company, he has this idea of completely changing the transportation industry by digging tunnels under the ground. You know, what do you think of this?
Yeah, so I think that, it's interesting. So a lot of, almost all major automotive companies are investing into all sorts of technologies related to transportation and artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, even companies like us, because they see a future where not everyone is going to be owning their own personal car. Or if they are, they may be, you know, leasing it out or running like businesses with it, like Uber drivers do, for example. So it's interesting to see how Volkswagen and GM and Ford have bought out all these small mobility companies, are investing heavily into them, because they see this landscape changing drastically. So I think they're definitely helping and pushing it forward. Obviously, the whole autonomous vehicle world will change the landscape of transportation, because when you remove the driver from the equation, there's a lot more opportunities that get open. Even on our end, you know, the most expensive cost of running a bus is the driver's salary. So, and not saying that that's what we're pushing for, I mean, we're a long way away from it, but it's going to definitely have an impact on the cost of running transportation services, the environmental impact, the opportunities that come about with it. But then there's also a lot of risks that you need to consider as well regarding safety and pollution on that front. There's a lot of topics you brought up there. So with the Boring company, I think it's quite interesting. I'm of the opinion, so we've taken an approach to the business that similar to Uber, in the sense where they're trying to make use of unused vehicles in a more optimal way, that are kind of sitting in parking lots or in people's driveways all the time. We're trying to make better use of buses and optimize those. So I'm of the opinion that I think the current road network and the current vehicles that we have, we can solve a lot of the congestion issues by just reorganizing and optimizing how people are using these services, how they're operated, versus, you know, making highways bigger, building tunnels. Yes, this will give more road space, but just like, you know, expanding highways has not been proven to reduce congestion. I don't have a strong opinion on the Boring company. I think it's really really the technology that he's using to build the tunnels is super cool. I've seen those videos. So I think he's making a lot of advances just in the field of, like, you know, construction and infrastructure development.
Is it the best way to solve the problem?
Yeah, so let's think through the problem that he is solving. So if we look at like LA, for example, they have huge, like, you know, 6-lane highways that are always congested and and there's always traffic jams. It takes forever to get anywhere. So yeah, that is one. If you're saying, okay, I don't have enough space on the road for all these cars, and there's also, you know, I know that with the tunnels, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there isn't. You can go like faster. You can go faster, and there's no kind of roadblocks or things like there's no street.
Pedestrians.
Yeah, no pedestrians, no stop signs, no intersections. So it's kind of a more direct route. So that is potentially one solution if the cause of we don't have enough space on the road, and you know the stoplights integrating with pedestrians, and then we could leave the roads more for cyclists and people walking or for public transit, for buses and things like that. So that is one solution. I'm the business case for it. I don't know enough about the economics of, you know, digging tunnels and who's paying for that and who's financing. I imagine that the city will be investing into that infrastructure, but I think that before we invest into major permanent infrastructure like that, we need to really think long term over you know, how it could potentially be used. It's not like like a startup or like Uber where you can kind of experiment and if things don't work, we could pivot and try something else. Can't really do that once you've built a tunnel for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and put in a road there. So, yeah, so I think, yeah, very cool. Don't have an amazing, you know, knowledge or opinion on that. What I will say, though, is going back to the kind of artificial intelligence aspect to it, I think that any entrepreneur needs to be thinking right now as to how machine learning and artificial intelligence is going to disrupt their industry. Because I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that you can make. You, even if you are at the forefront of innovation, like I would like to think that we are, we're also thinking about how we could be disrupted by machine learning and artificial intelligence in a couple of years or right now. Right now, what we're working on is actually models to predict ridership in the future for our services and even for regular public transit. For those of you who don't know much about machine learning, it's basically just prediction. You're training models to, you know, look at all this past data so that when you feed it new data, it predicts what's going to happen with a high degree of confidence. And so that's what we're in the process of building for public transportation services, and in particular our on-demand transportation services, that based on, you know, months or years of data of people using our service, what do we think ridership is going to look like 2 weeks from now, a month from now? Where is the request, where is the demands, are the demands going to come from, and with what volume? So that's how what we're dealing with right now. And then we're also thinking about integrating with autonomous vehicle fleets. Once we have autonomous buses, autonomous vehicles on the road, they're going to need to know where to go. It's, you know, you have the autonomous buses that are going to be developed are probably going to cost a few million dollars at first. You don't want to have these, you know, multi-million dollar vehicles on the road empty, not picking anyone up. The risk there is even higher. So I think, and even the same thing for a Tesla, for any autonomous vehicle, we need to figure out where to route them and at what times based on requests. So yeah, Uber and Lyft are one provider of this potential technology, but there's others out there like us, which we're equally as qualified to provide that level of sophistication to actually optimize a whole fleet of autonomous vehicles.
Listen, man, to close things off, I have one question that was sent to me from someone in the community.
Sure.
It's from Ed Ben, the hero on Instagram username. And his question is, when can you expect, if you were to pinpoint a date on the calendar, when can you expect autonomous vehicles to represent the majority of transportation in the industry? Like, just if you could drop a pin. No need to explain, need to, like a projection.
Where they represent the majority?
Yeah.
I'd say 2030, probably in about a decade. Again, this is not you know, I don't know the latest stats off the top of my head, but I would say in the next 10 years, we could likely see a lot of people. But I mean, autonomous vehicles, they don't help solve the problem of traffic congestion. Like whether you're sitting, maybe you're in the back seat and you could be more productive and less stressed, but if there's, you know, 1,000 vehicles on the road, whether they're autonomous or driven by humans, there's still 1,000 vehicles on the road. So that's one thing that we need to consider, is that is there, and great if they're electric, but you know, not all of them will be electric. And so is there a more sustainable way that we could be getting people to where they need to go?
It's interesting what you just mentioned, that yeah, sure, people will still be sitting in the car, but what's interesting is why do people hate congestion? Why does the government hate congestion? It's because it's unproductive time spent doing something that's really unproductive. You're just sitting here wasting fuel, you know, versus you could be at home, you could be in the office working, you could be spending money somewhere. So this unproductive time, so it's interesting to think about it in the sense that you could use that hour and actually be productive during that hour.
Yeah, you could be productive, exactly. Just like you could, I'll make the argument again for public transit, is that you could be sitting on a bus or sitting on the metro or a train, also being productive. So if people really want to invest into autonomous vehicles so that they can be productive along their commute, why not take, you know, save your $100,000 or $200,000 and take a mode of transport that's already existing that would allow you to be productive. You know, every time I'm sitting on the bus, I'm either reading or I have my laptop out responding to emails. It's surprising the amount that you can do when, especially when you maybe don't even have an internet connection and you can just, you know, plow through a bunch of emails or documents or get a lot of reading, important reading done. So I would say consider, why you really want an autonomous vehicle and how sustainable it is down the road too. Those are the things that I would think.
And do you have any announcements to make about Blaze?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff coming up for us, but on our end, we're recruiting three positions right now. So the first is a transport project specialist. So someone that has a background in either project planning or transportation engineering that will work with us to implement the on-demand services with our bus operator clients, so with the large transit authorities. So that'll be kind of the liaison between us and our tech teams and the transit authorities. The second is a full stack mobile and web developer that'll be working on all of our mobile technologies. So the mobile app for passengers that we have, the driver app that gives navigation instructions, and then the platform that allows the transit authorities to manage that. So it'll be someone who will be working across all three on front end and back end. So those are the two. And then we always hire at least a couple interns every semester. So we're already starting to recruit for the fall 2020 semester. So if you're an engineering student looking for a job, head to our careers page on our website. So blazetransit.com/careers, I believe, or you could just navigate from it from our homepage. So we have all the positions listed there. And if you think that Blaze is something that your city would benefit from as well, feel free to reach out to us or to reach out to your transit authority or local city officials as well and tell them that, you know, this technology is out there and companies like Blaze could provide that solution to you.
So. Where can people find your company and yourself on social media?
Yeah, so all of our handles are Blaze Transit, so that's BLAISE Transit. You can find us on Instagram, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, Facebook. We're pretty much all across the board. And if you want to, you know, reach out to me personally, the email and form on our website, I see all of those in our inbox. So if you love what we're doing, and even if we're, you know, you're super passionate about transportation and we don't have an opening that's right for you, like reach out to me through LinkedIn or through our website, and I'd love to chat with you and see what opportunities there are for us to work together in the future. So,
Justin, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much, Leon. It was a pleasure, and it was great to be here and to talk about engineering and entrepreneurship.